I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, another installment of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. Active Shooter, a violent video game, has been pulled from its online platform, at least for the moment, following strong criticism, particularly from survivors of recent school shootings. Samantha Bee and Roseanne Barr are no strangers to criticism these days. They each offended, but did they offend in the same way, and should they be punished in the same manner? Plus, new mother Serena Williams has won more Grand Slam events than any other woman in the history of tennis. Yet, she was forced to enter the French Open as an unseeded player. The politics of pregnancy and a fashion statement that's about a lot more than clothes. Midday Culture Connections. That's up next, right after the news. Good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Before we begin today, an update on the Democratic primary for governor. Anne Arundel County Circuit Judge William C. Mulford ruled yesterday that the Maryland Board of Elections is not required to reprint ballots to reflect the change in Valerie Irvin's position in the race. Ms. Irvin is the former lieutenant governor candidate who was running with Kevin Kamenetz. Mr. Kamenetz died suddenly on May 10th, and about a week later, Ms. Irvin decided to enter the primary as a candidate for governor herself. She chose Baltimore County Board of Education member Marisol Johnson as her running mate. In Judge Mulford's ruling yesterday, he agreed with Linda Lamone, the State Board of Elections Administrator, who contended that with only a week and a half to go before early voting begins, and with several thousand absentee ballots already mailed to those voters, it is too late to print new ballots with Ms. Irvin's name as the gubernatorial candidate and Ms. Johnson as the lieutenant governor candidate. The idea of placing stickers on the current ballots with the Irvin-Johnson ticket was also rejected out of fear that the stickers would somehow gum up the machines that read the results. Instead, voters will be instructed that to vote for the Irvin-Johnson ticket, they should fill in the oval for Kamenetz-Irvin for that ticket. And as of last night, Ms. Irvin was said to be considering an appeal of the ruling. We'll keep you posted as developments continue. And by the way, the latest televised debate between the Democratic candidates for governor will be aired tonight at 6 o'clock on WJZ-TV. It will include the top seven candidates in the race. There are nine altogether. My interviews with each of those seven candidates are available when you subscribe to the Midday podcast or when you find our Conversations with the Candidates series on the WYPR website. So now we turn to our good friend, Dr. Sherry Parks, for our monthly feature, the Midday Culture Connections. Hey, Sherry, good to see you.
Good to see you.
So when last we spoke, you were on the faculty of the University of Maryland, where you had been for some 30 years.
Yeah.
And now you are 5 days into a new tenure at the Maryland Institute College of Art.
Well, officially only 2 days.
Two days, yeah.
Yeah, but I was around before then to get some training from Mike Moeller.
So again, the stuff you're doing at MICA, a little bit different than what you were doing at University of Maryland.
Almost somewhat. I mean, a lot of it is community engaged research and building platforms for faculty. And I was doing that, some of it in Baltimore as an associate dean. And as I say, Michael was watching me play in their yard and
decided to kidnap you.
Huh? Well, I wasn't exactly kidnapping. I was willing.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So bunch of stuff we can talk about. What's on your mind for the Culture Connection today?
Well, what I just, you know, off the top of my head.
Yeah, right. With no forethought whatsoever.
No forethought or whatever. Right. But certainly there's lots and lots to talk about. But the three I think that we need to talk about. One is the active shooter game that's been pulled. But I think there's still a conversation because if they were naming it truthfully, it would be school shooter game. And there's a lot of neuroscience behind that I think the media isn't paying attention to as to why this is not just about imitation. There's more to that than that. And then, you know, several weeks ago, we actually were ahead of the curve when we talked about pregnancy and discrimination. And now Serena Williams is shaping the discourse around that as she had prepared to go back onto the professional circuit and some decisions she was forced to make about whether she was nursing or not or competing. Mm-hmm. And now there's been a documentary series about that.
So yeah, it's been on HBO.
Right. We're all participating in that. And then it's probably time to dig a little, if you can stand it a little more, the Samantha Bee, Roseanne Barr discussion, because there really hasn't been much of a discussion because people are trying to make, on the right, this equivalency of the two incidents.
Yeah, the comments that Roseanne Barr made on Twitter about Valerie Jarrett and the comments that Samantha Bee made on her program about Ivanka Trump.
Yes, thank you. And I think we need to dig into that about why they probably are not equivalent situations.
All right, so plenty to chat amiably about. Indeed. This active shooter thing. The game, as you mentioned, is called Active Shooter. It is a video game. It was supposed to be released tomorrow on a thing called Steam, which is a gaming platform, I guess the biggest online gaming platform in the world. They are based over in Washington State. They're going to charge $5 to $10 for this thing, and it was advertised in its marketing materials as saying that players would be able to choose between portraying a SWAT team member or portraying the actual shooter who is in a building, a school building, or sometimes an office building. I understand that there was a score board as part of this game that listed the number of CIVs shot, civilians, and police shot, cops and CIVs. So you kept track of the number of people who were killed. So how do you get yourself into a mindset of somebody who would be interested in this game and even interested in making this game?
Well, and just think about it. I mean, if the point is to rack up the most scores, there are more CIVs available to be shot than there are SWAT team members to be shot. So that simple psychology. But first, I need to explain, you know, why I even think about this. And so those of you in the audience who've listened a long time may remember that, you know, Dave Zurawiec and I did a show, and we won an award from the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry for the analysis of media. And so, and my grad degrees are in the behavioral sciences. So if you're thinking, well, why is Sherry trying to wrap her brain around that? It's kind of unfortunately.
Plenty of reasons for you to wrap your brain anything. Yeah.
So really, there's some things that people know about, that these games lead to desensitization, that the more you play it, the less it matters to you. And it's certainly when soldiers are being prepared to fight, they actually go through a desensitization aspect, because it's hard to kill another human being unless you see them as a thing, as an object, as an other. And so we know about that, and we know that people, particularly boys, will imitate violence as they see and participate. We know that with gaming, that involvement becomes even more, because you're not just watching it, you're participating, you're killing people. We know that the military uses gaming both as a recruitment device and a training device. I'm actually more interested in the recruitment device, because therein lies what I think is not being reported. So now there's a lot of neuroscience research around gaming. Gaming, the reward center, the word center is important, is the ventral striatum. That is the pleasure center for sex and food. So the primal pleasures that enable our survival as individuals and as a species. So the body is very, very motivated to do these things. And the word center, I know scientists hate it when those of us use other metaphors. It really is the matrix. It's where a lot of those pleasure centers come. And so it's this center thing. So these drives are really, really important and really, really felt. So, like, you know, sex and food in moderation, you know.
Yeah, basic survival stuff. Yeah,
but taken in moderation is part of a good life. And gaming, I'm not saying that all gamers will be affected, but the fact that this gives you such important pleasure is part of it. And so I'm not talking about the extremes. I'm not talking about people who are addicted, although that's been well documented. I'm talking about people who are heavy users but not yet addicted. And can this change so that you are not only just imagining this, you're participating in shooting up a school, and you're getting enormous pleasure from doing that. And that's the danger.
Yeah, that is incredibly dangerous. And is the pleasure the same kind of thing that you would get if you were winning at a game that wasn't violent? I mean, if you're playing Pac-Man, you know, back in the day as the early users used to play, or if you're playing a game of video solitaire, I mean, and you win, I mean, you feel good, you get a little boost. Is it the same thing? I mean, is the fact that there is the potential for pleasure from the killing of another human being, even if it's a video simulation. What does that say?
Well, and I would love for listeners to call in and speak to that. But think about it. I mean, you eat food, right?
Lots of it.
Well, okay. Well, no. Well, notice the smile. I can see the smile of pleasure, but the listeners can hear it. So, you know, what's the difference between eating something that you're hungry is not the thing that you necessarily want versus this exquisite pleasure that you've gone to a great restaurant? And so we're talking about matter of degree, and we're talking about degrees of pleasure. And so, yes, I'm making this analogy between, you know, you enjoy Pac-Man, you know, but this is an extreme emotional experience, and so it's a matter of degree.
410-662-8780. That's our number here on Midday for Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. If you want to drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. You mentioned the military. I think people can understand how video games would be very helpful in simulating combat situations. But it is very interesting that you also say it's actually used in recruitment.
Yes, yes. Well, and we also said, before we move to that second point, is that this is increasingly what war, actual war, looks like. That we're sending fewer bodies onto the field and operating drones. And people are beginning to plan for war by robot. And so those folks are sitting in front of screens. And so they're not acting like war. It is war. But I am more interested, and you are too, in the recruitment. Because recruitment means you take an average citizen, you know, that, you know, boys and sometimes girls have participated in violent play acting for generations. But that doesn't make you a soldier. The first thing you do is to train the idea that the thing for good people to do in the face of badness is to kill it. There's an old media, an example from He-Man. Do you remember He-Man?
I don't. Sorry.
Oh, okay. So,
a video game?
It was a TV show.
Oh.
It's
a cartoon.
But
I guess,
was the first time. Yeah, it was a cartoon. It was the first time that there was an onboard psychiatrist on a show. They didn't put any money into production. Those who remembered, it was partial animation. And so Evil was never killed. Skeletor was always allowed to go back into the forest to come back another day. And they got a lot of hate mail that said, what are you doing? How do we keep a standing army if boys, particularly boys at the time, don't believe that they can vanquish evil, that they can kill it? So that socialization of what do you do in the face of evil? You kill it, means, okay, and then who do you define as the evil other? Well, in some games, it's pretty clear. I mean, nobody's going to say, well, the Nazis shouldn't be. But here, in this game, you're being asked to kill the good people or the bad people. But to go back to the recruiting element, if you're activating the primal reward center for doing something that is seen as virtuous, I mean, wouldn't you, if you were a military recruiter, see this as a major asset? And so you can play these games for free. I mean, you can go online now and play these games for free.
And we should make it clear, by the way, that Active Shooter number one has been pulled. It has not been actually released. It was scheduled to be released tomorrow. It's not going to happen. It may happen at some point. The person who says he developed it is using a name that people are not even sure is a real name. He calls himself Atta Berdyaev. He has been removed from this platform in the past because he was operating other things as a troll. He's got a bad history.
Maybe abusive
to people. You know, there's that whole stuff. So the game isn't actually going to be available.
But it's not
and the
first...
military is not using this game,
right.
Or they never suggested that active shooter would be something that they would use right. as either a training thing or a recruitment.
Well, they do use first-person shooters for, mm-hmm. for recruitment and training. I mean, we should make that clear. And yes, you're right. I don't want to suggest that they're using this game. We also should make clear that this is not the first school shooter game. This is just the first one with this big a platform and production values, if you can call it that. And unfortunately, it probably will not be the last.
Yeah, there are games called Hatred, Postal, Carmageddon. And as a matter of fact, the developers of this game initially tried to defend it by saying, look, this isn't the worst of the lot, that there's even worse stuff that is currently commercially available. What strikes me about it as a distinction between this one and perhaps other games in which you can play the shooter is that in those games, it seems to me, and I'm by no means an expert, that the people you're shooting can also also have the capacity to shoot you. So that you are literally in an armed conflict with other people. If you're in a school, you're shooting people who have no recourse other than to hide, right?
Well,
that seems to be a huge difference.
And obviously, I have not played the game, but I have watched some scenes from it. And in one of them that I found, I think most of us would find particularly heartbreaking, the children are huddled in a corner, cowering. And they're still there to be shot.
They make a game of this. This is just, words escape me. To
which
think
is
about
why.
A person who would have the impulse to say, this would be fun.
Which is why you have to go back to the Pleasure Center.
We will talk about that. We will return to the Pleasure Center right here in Studio A when we come back from a break. Dr. Sherry Parks is our guest. Today it's Midday Culture Connections. Our phone number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. To send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. We'll be right back. Stick around.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Thanks for being with us. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, The People and the Policy Around the Foster Care System. This weekend, the Fostering Change Network Foundation is going to hold a conference here in Baltimore. It's a gathering of professionals who are alumni of the foster care system, foster care professionals, foster parents, advocates, and young people who are transitioning out of foster care. I'll be joined by Shalita O'Neill. She's the founder and CEO of the Fostering Change Network Foundation and an attorney from Washington named Jelani Freeman. We'll have a conversation about life after foster care and the unique challenges facing young adults as they transition out of the system into independence. So that's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. At the moment, we're talking about this video game that has recently been pulled, scheduled for release tomorrow. It ain't going to happen. It's called Active Shooter. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. So, Sherry, when it comes to video games and in terms of its, the studies that are linking violent behavior to the young boys mostly who play these games, and there are people who dispute some of that research, but they say that the link is too casual. They point to the fact, for example, that juvenile crime nationwide is actually down while violent video games and the sales of such are actually up. So, you know, to show causality is not accurate. But I wonder, first of all, do video games hold a special place in this panoply of research that connects violence to the playing of the games? What's the difference between video games and just movies and television and YouTube and all the violent stuff that you can get in any other number of media places?
Well, I do want to say that there's a difference between violence and crime. Crime, to be a crime, someone has to be subject to the justice system. There's a lot of violence that goes on in middle and upper class spaces that don't become crimes. And so that and you were just saying an argument that other people are saying, it's questionable. Well, which is why I was staying with the neuroscientific research. But we also have to say that gaming has now gone mainstream. I mean, it's being used in classrooms. There's a type of serious gaming that's gone on for pro-social purposes. And so, but you asked about why it might be different from other media. What we know about learning is that the more involved you are, the more you learn, the deeper and more persistent the learning. Video games are by definition more involving. Anything, any teacher will tell you, if you can get the kids can sit there and listen to the lesson, but if you get them actively doing the lesson, that the learning will be deeper and more persistent. Video games basically do that, that they pull you into the scenario, you are in it. Now, I also need to say that now we have a generation of mostly males who have been gaming for most of their lives. And we're seeing that that's who's going into immersive design and augmented reality, and they know it. You don't have to teach it to them. They know how to use the technique. And I've been in a situation when I've seen...
So they're going into those fields as careers.
Right, careers.
I mean, and Micah has a whole thing about people who design video games. They do the music for video games, all that stuff.
Right, right. And so it can be used for good. I've actually been able... I mean, I taught a class this past semester where the VR club met with and worked with student athletes and created motion capture and did a lot of work around
that. And VR is what? I'm sorry?
Virtual reality.
Virtual reality.
Right. So I've seen people who were gaming computer natives talking to, working with people who were, for the most part, didn't have lots of, you know, Xboxes and you know, that sort of thing. And it was difficult for the VR people to teach at first without a mediator, which was kind of my role, because it was in their bones. I mean, they knew this so well and were so invested in it that it was hard to pull it up and explain the lessons behind it. And so, but you now have a group of people who will be highly privileged because they've been gaming. There's this fallout, too. I mean, many of them at that level of sophistication are no longer playing first shooter games. They're much larger and more complex, interesting games to be had. But if you stay with what we're talking about, this first shooter game, what you're learning, what you're involved in is not watching a Western, which is very problematic, or even a crime show, which is very problematic. You are investing your energy, your participation, your emotional investment.
It's not passive. Yeah. It's not, you're not just sitting there watching a movie. You're in the movie in a way.
Well,
or is passive the wrong word?
Yeah. Do you think the people who watch music is passive? There's lots of activity going on. I'm saying it's deeper, more persistent activity going on, because there is brain work to watching.
It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, now of the Maryland Institute College of Art. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. Let's go to the phones. John in Catonsville, welcome to the show with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm enjoying the show. Appreciate the coverage on this subject. And my question or comment is, I wonder if there's any value in having a handle on who the people are who are interested in this kind of a game. And so could you flip the script and allow this game to be released, but include some kind of mandatory registration of some sort so that to have access to the game, people are required to give up their anonymity for being interested in that kind of a, you know, what most people would consider pretty sick interest.
All right. Thanks for the call, John. In terms of who's doing it, CNN reports 97% of kids between the ages of 12 and 17 play video games. It's virtually everybody.
Yeah.
And it's a 21+ billion-dollar domestic industry. So there's a lot of money at play, and there's a lot of audience for this. Now, there are even video game things that are now public spectacles. I mean, you pay a ticket and you buy a ticket and you go to an auditorium to watch, or a stadium to watch people play mm-hmm. video games. This thing,
and you can make a career of that
yeah.
as a performer.
Yeah.
And so part of that is that for boys, the market is pretty much saturated. The growth market is for girls. Although there's not been as much success as often they're kind of imitation boy games, and they make them pink, and there's a little less violence. But I mean, there's some good work out there. It's not necessarily getting as much of a market. I mean, so John's question is there a way? Oh, you betcha there's a way. I mean, years ago, there were some of us who were saying, you know, your Xbox is watching you, and now we know your Xbox is watching you. And I worry about the ethical implications of that. But that information is already being gathered to some degree. When you register, they have
yeah.
that.
They have your name, your address, your age, probably whether you're lying or not, and a credit card.
So and your location.
Yeah, and I mean, your location.
Not because you've told them. Maybe you did and maybe you didn't. But your
they can figure it out.
Your system knows where you are.
Yeah, Leo in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hello, Sherry. I guess I would just be kind of dovetailing on the last comment made, but when people look up a racist or a sort of socially unacceptable meme, I guess you can kind of perhaps extrapolate a prediction of where perhaps school shootings may be available in may be happening in the future. I guess I was hoping you could maybe comment on that.
Well, yeah, thanks for the call, Leo.
It's interesting because if you do a longitudinal study, as some people have done, not everybody who uses violent or racist or we should say sexist video games acts on that. There tends to be some attitudinal change that might be acted out in some milder ways. But one of the things that predicts how violent the 18-year-old will be is how much violent content the 8-year-old consumes. So you have to follow people for a while to predict. And notice, you won't predict anything for the majority of the population because there are lots of things that stop people from acting out their violent impulses.
I do want to leave this topic and talk a little bit about Serena Williams, which I think is a really fascinating story that's just unfolding this week. But before we do, one quick comment about the politics of this. Some of the most vocal opponents to the release of this active shooter video game were survivors of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting in Parkland. And then, of course, subsequent to that, there was this horrible shooting on the 18th of May in Santa Fe, Texas. Is this an indication? Because it was their vocal opposition to this that certainly played what appears to be a pretty major role in the developer's decision to withdraw this game. Is this an indication of some growing political power?
I think so. And we should mention that the Santa Fe students joined the Florida students. So they didn't try to start their own movement. They were savvy enough to say, you know, we're going to get on this bus that's already moving. I think so. I think we've had school shootings before, and certainly the Connecticut shooting of the small children, the folks in that movement thought that would be the tipping point. But it's taken, I think, the students themselves taking on their agency and making this and not going away and being politically savvy. And I think this is a success for them.
Well, plenty more to talk about this, and we will probably talk about it in future shows here on Midday. But I do want to move to Serena Williams, who was scheduled to play Maria Sharapova in the fourth round of the French Open. Yesterday, she had to retire, not from tennis, but from that tournament because she has an injury. But she was away for 14 months having a baby. And WTA, the Women's Tennis Association policy, states that when you take that much of a leave and you come back, even if you are what most people think is the single greatest woman tennis player in the history of the game, you enter the tournament unseeded, which is interesting. And we talked about
400 slots down.
Yeah. She was number one, of course. So there's that. There's what she wore at the French Open, this incredible cat suit a black suit that was, you know, it's pants and a top that's all connected rather than the sort of, you know, tennis skirt that you're used to seeing. And then there's a big controversy about her trainer and her regimen of breastfeeding her new baby. So can you unpack a little bit about the trainer part first? Can tell us what happened in that situation?
Okay. And we should mention there's an HBO documentary series that's tracing that. So we're all participating in this. And I said that a bit earlier, but to bring it back in. So most sports take advantage of what men do best. There are other things that women do best that I don't particularly want to see sports do, which is, you know, we're good in droughts and things like that. So Serena has been criticized because her body is very muscular, and that, I mean, she's got this powerful game, and you know, if you've watched her at all, I mean, sometimes the other players almost want to jump out of the way because her service are strong. And that's been an ongoing controversy about whether she's beautiful or not. And she's talked about how that has affected her. So nursing takes up a lot of energy. And having a baby takes up a lot. But nursing takes up over a long period of time. And I think she was into the eighth month of nursing, which makes her a long-term nurser. But her trainer was arguing that she wasn't strong enough. She wasn't back to where she was, not because she wasn't training hard enough, not that she wasn't doing all the other things, but she had her baby with her and she was nursing. And in the HBO series, we see him saying early on, you have to stop nursing, and her saying, I don't want to. I can't do that.
Here's a clip of Serena Williams from this HBO documentary that you mentioned talking about this very thing.
I've been a tennis player basically my entire life. I've been a mom for 8 months. Honestly, I shouldn't have to choose between these two identities. And I think I'm learning that in almost every way, I don't. Breastfeeding is an incredibly personal thing. The connection that it gives me to Olympia, it's been one of the most magical things I've ever experienced.
So here she is as a professional person in that incredibly demanding profession. And it sounds like her trainer is saying, you got to choose.
Yeah. And what happens after that is she does choose and she stops nursing. And there's scenes where, you know, Olympia, notice the name, Olympia
the baby,
is not having it. And, you know, Olympia wants to nurse, and it's very hard for Serena to live with that, because, you know, but she does finally makes the choice that she wants to go back to what she was before she had the baby. She's at that episode ends with her being ready for the French Open, and we see the scene that says the queen is back. And when she pulls out, and we have to say that if you're a competitor, even if you're training hard, being away for a while makes you more prone to injury. I haven't seen anybody make that link that this might have been because she was out having a baby. I suspect there's lots of gossip that's going on there. But in her statement after she pulls out, she's very, very upset. She says, this is particularly heartbreaking because of what I had to give up. And she specifically mentions, she doesn't say nursing or breastfeeding, she says, time with my daughter.
There's a woman named Rebecca Slaughter who was profiled in the New York Times over the weekend. She was appointed to the Federal Trade Commission in March, which happened to coincide with the birth of her third child. And she takes the baby to work. So she's got the kind of job in this office in D.C. in which she can have the baby strapped to her chest in one of those, you know, cloth things, right, or in a rockaroo, you know, on the floor. We hear about other, you know, prominent executives who have their own nanny show up with them to work and all that kind of stuff. So there are obviously certain kinds of jobs and certain kinds of professions where that's okay. If you're working at Home Depot or at Lowe's, chances are not high that they're going to let you take your baby to work with you. So there is this comes down to class and economic privilege and what you can do and what you can't do. This is the the stuff surrounding pregnancy and parenthood is really, really complex.
And while the HBO series talks about it as an emotional issue, notice the background music, which was very emotional. And I admit I'm biased. I was a long-term nurser as well. I mean, the micronutrients, they're now linking it to self-confidence because the child feels strong. Serena talks about the eye gazing, and now there's studies about that eye gazing. And some of that you get, and this is not meant to, if women choose not to nurse to make them feel guilty, but the women who get to make that choice to be long-term nursers, as you point out, one, have to have jobs that are fairly sedentary, that you're not moving around, you're not doing landscape architecting, even if you own the firm. But if you have extreme privilege or a sedentary job and a clean, safe space to nurse or pump, then you can do it. The vast majority of women don't have that.
Yeah, and there are organizations who are making public accommodations for people who want to nurse in a way that they hadn't before. Amtrak stations, including the one right here in Baltimore, now have a quiet, secluded place where you can go and nurse your baby.
And I haven't been in the Amtrak one specifically, but some of those places are not the particularly maintained. So even if they provide them, there's a maintenance issue.
Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art and a regular contributor to our show on Midday Culture Connections. She is the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. And we'll have more with Sherry Parks when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Holmes. Stick around.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's the Midday Culture Connections. I'm Tom Hall here in Studio A with Dr. Sherry Parks. If you're just joining us, we are discussing, among other things, Serena Williams' return to professional tennis following her 14-month maternity leave, the politics of women and pregnancy in the workplace. If you want to chime in, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and to send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. Let's go to the phones, Sherry. Michael in Canton, welcome to the Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hello.
Hi, Michael. What's on your mind?
So regarding the conversation you just had about Serena Williams, I wanted to chime in that my wife is currently a returning graduate student at Towson University for psychology. She's 30 years old, and I've been sort of shocked recently how many of her advisors and her teachers have told her that she needs to make a choice between either having a kid or fully pursuing her career, and especially in the field and the socioeconomic status that most graduate psychology students are in, that people still feel like that's a binary choice.
Sherry Parks, you are fully ensconced in academia yourself.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, it's certainly not limited to that idea. It's certainly not limited to Towson University. And the baby's here, right? So it's not a choice at this point. The baby's here. She's not going to give up her career. But that idea that you cannot be a professional woman and take care of a baby is still hanging out there. And it has so many implications where people are being forced to be a mom or to be a professional, which, of course, men don't have to. Even though many more men are taking paternity leave and are actively parenting, they still aren't forced into that choice. And it's a terrible situation for a woman to be in.
You know, and I've mentioned this before, one of the things that just drives Linnell and myself crazy, Linnell's my wife, and we are the parents of a 29-year-old woman who's our daughter. But this notion that she was a full-time journalist with the Baltimore Sun when our daughter was born. I was a full-time musician doing other things. The two of us worked full-time. I considered myself a full-time father, and she considered herself a full-time mother. But the term full-time mother in the 1980s, when our daughter was born, was meant to suggest the person who doesn't have a job outside the home. We will, to the day we die, be full-time parents. I mean, you just can't escape that.
And it gets to the issue between about equity versus equality, that men and women are not exactly the same beings. Somebody is carrying that baby in their body. And in order for her to have the same lack of obstacles, just notice that the flip I just did, there needs to be some consideration of what it means to be a professional and carrying a body. I got pregnant with Kelsey. I found out I was pregnant the same day I took a job as an associate dean at the university. And so I lived that with people asking me when I was going home or being really uncomfortable or assuming that I was going to step down after she was born. And women saying, what are you doing? You know, when I'm already pregnant, so it's not. And so women get shoved into this corner that is untenable and awful.
Speaking of Serena Williams, she tweeted when pictures of her catsuit were published after her first match. She says, "Catsuit, anybody? For all the moms out there who had a tough recovery from pregnancy, here you go. If I can do it, so can you. Love you all." So Serena is making this fashion statement, which many people saw a connection and a lineage to Black Panther and Wakanda and the costumes that were in that movie.
Well, we have to talk about Halle Berry first.
But yes, but Serena herself had sported a catsuit back in 2011. Right, so this was, she was ahead of that curve, right, you know, to be sure. But, you know, the business of power and control and agency as a mother, here's Serena Williams just demonstrating it to a T. Beautiful.
Well, and of course, the cat suit is equated with being sexy. And so, you know, what she did is she got her muscles back. And so there's this interesting mix of messages where she's wearing the cat suit that shows all of her curves and all of her muscles. And she walks out. It's also black. And most tennis wear, traditionally it was white, now there's much more color, but you will see very few bodies that are completely clothed from head to toe in blackness. And so and the statement at first when you say, well, if I can do it, well, wait a minute, you're a highly competitive athlete, you were in amazing shape before you started, but she did fight to get back into shape. I wonder about that message, because getting, quote, back into shape isn't easy. And I think in her messaging, she didn't say, and this is how I suffered to do this. This is really hard. It wasn't quite as encouraging as I think she meant it to be, because most of us are not looking like that after a few months.
Yeah. And this pallor of people equating but bringing up the notion of Serena as a beautiful woman compared to particularly some other women on the tennis tour has been with her and her sister Venus for the entire time that they've been in the public eye.
Which is why the meet that she was about to do was particularly poignant, you know, because her opponent has been feted for being, quote, beautiful.
This is Maria Sharapova.
All right.
As a matter of fact, in one of the post-match press conferences just the other day, this guy named Bill Simmons, who is a writer for an online publication called Inside Tennis, says after the 2004 Wimbledon match between Serena and Maria Sharapova, who is a tennis player of Russian origin, who now lives in the United States and has for a long time. This guy says, and this is a question to Serena Williams in a post-match press conference. "I had the opportunity to interview Donald Trump on his LA golf course, and he said that Maria's shoulders were incredibly alluring. And then he came up with this incredible analysis that you," meaning Miss Williams, "were intimidated by her supermodel good looks. My question is, have you ever been intimidated by anyone on a tennis court? And what are your thoughts about that occurrence?"
Well, and it was interesting.
It just makes your head explode someone say that out loud.
And it's certainly been argued in sports circles that Sharapova has gotten as much attention as she's gotten, covers of magazines and endorsements, because of the way she looks. Because her tennis career has not equaled Serena Williams or other top female players.
Yeah, and by the way, people played up this rivalry, so-called, between Serena Williams and Maria Sharapova, and Serena Williams has beaten her 19 times.
Mm-hmm.
And Sharapova has won in that matchup twice. So it's really not even close when it comes to who's actually the better tennis player.
Well, and race obviously is an issue here, too, because Sharapova is blonde and white, and Russian, and Serena obviously is an African-American woman.
And by the way, Serena Williams' reply to this question by this reporter is, I honestly don't have any thoughts about that. I can't say I have been intimidated by anyone. That's all. That's it. And I think the record is pretty clear that she's intimidated by very few people, if anybody.
And one of the things you can say about sports is there's some times and places where beauty doesn't matter so much. And I would say on the court is one of them.
Yeah, in 2015, she was asked why she didn't smile enough. I mean, this whole thing, it's just amazing. And every time I encounter something with her in the media, she's more impressive.
And competing smiles are not part of, if you are trying to intimidate your opponent, smiling is the last thing you're going to do.
Yeah, exactly, if you're going to be intimidating. By the way, as a footnote, Miss America, the beauty pageant, announced today that they will no longer have a swimsuit competition. I just put that out there for your general edification.
Well, yeah.
Because of this notion of beauty and how important it is, and, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. So does that indicate some evolution?
Well, you know, I'm going to differentiate between beauty and sexuality because they're not analogous, and that obviously suggests that it is. If they're smart, they will figure out something real for the women to compete about.
Before we go, I do want to ask you about Roseanne Barr and Samantha Bee. We don't have a whole lot of time, but Samantha Bee is putatively going to address the controversy that her remark about Ivanka Trump has engendered. She's going to do that tomorrow night. That's the next night she's on the air on her program called Full Frontal. Samantha Bee, a blatantly racist comment about Valerie Jarrett, former advisor to President Obama. Samantha Bee calling Ms. Trump derogatory, you know, swear word, for lack of a better.
Yeah, we can't say on the
air. We can't say on the air and wouldn't want to.
No.
And people on the right saying, okay, if Roseanne Barr lost her television show, Samantha Bee should lose her television show.
It's not the same. And what gets missed in that false analogy is that Samantha Bee said it on her show as opposed to what is presumably a private. We don't know quite whether the social media is private or public, certainly. And Samantha Bee's...
I would say it's public, yeah.
Well, is it public when, you know, private citizens use it? It's the same platform. So it's problematic. I would suggest that Roseanne Barr is using it as if it were public and it does the same thing. But in terms of what is protected speech by the Constitution, specifically Samantha Bee is protected that way. The only way she's not protected is that profanity is not protected in the case law that's come down, but the other places that it was her public forum, her media forum, and humor is specifically protected. So
isn't Roseanne Barr protected as well? She can say anything she wants. Now, people don't have to watch her television show, and ABC doesn't have to continue airing it, but she can say anything she wants.
She can say whatever she wants. She is not protected from consequences in the same way that Samantha Bee is if she says it on her show. Now, if Roseanne had said this in the script of the Roseanne Barr show, she would be protected. The other thing that's different there is Samantha Bee, what's been overridden is that she was doing political commentary. And that, too, is specifically protected by the First Amendment.
Was it a mistake? She apologized for it.
Yes.
And Roseanne apologized for herself as well.
It was a mistake. She should have used a different word. And ironically, if she had used the B word, the other word, there would be no uproar. And the president has used that word, usually with son of a in front of it, repeatedly. And there's been no comment.
If Samantha Bee, just simply made a mistake, said something now she wishes she hadn't said, is that just one of those mistakes that, well, you blew it, you made a mistake, you got to pay the price. And the price is, you know, there may be advertisers, in fact, who decide to withdraw
they
from
have.
The show.
Some have already.
And, you know, so maybe TBS is going to say, well, this is no longer a viable economic model. You're out of here.
And they have the right to do that. But I think they would immediately have an enormous lawsuit in their hands because of what I just said about protected speech.
Dr. Sherry Parks, she's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art and the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman, and a monthly contributor to our program, joining us on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. We'll see you next month, Sherry. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation about life after foster care. Shalita O'Neill is the CEO and founder of Fostering Change Network. Jelani Freeman's an attorney in Washington. They join me for a conversation about their experiences in the foster care system and the realities facing young people today as they age out of the system and into independence. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank Joe's Squared for providing lunch today. Joe's Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall, out of the blocks with Aaron Henkin and Wendell Patrick coming up after news at the top of the hour. We appreciate your listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.